That was the opening of Cécile Chaminade's Étude Romantique in G flat, and it was performed by Claire Hammond. I'm Erica Worth, and welcome to this Pianist podcast. Today I am speaking to Claire about her latest recording of British piano concertos and much more. Claire, it's great to have you on the Pianist podcast today.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Listeners may or may not know. Be aware that Claire is the current Pianist magazine cover. That's the October-November issue. But today we're going to kick off with Claire's new album of British concertos by Walton, Britten and Tippett, which has just been released on the BIS label. Now, Claire, in your booklet notes, you describe how the piano takes on a slightly different role in each concerto. Maybe you can explain this to the listener.
Well, I think when you're playing a concerto, it's always very important to know what kind of role the composer has in mind for you. And that's often related to which period the concerto comes from. So, for example, with the Romantic concertos, you often have this bravura virtuosa model. With the three concertos on this disc, it's much more of a collaborative approach. And you can sense the composers reacting against that Romantic stereotype, as it were. But they do so in very different ways. So in the Walton Sinfonia Concertante, the part is much more of a piano obbligato part. It feels much more like an orchestral piano part than a concerto. And you're very much absorbed into the ensemble. With the Tippett, you're still very much bound with the texture, but it's more of a concerto part. It's much more complex, much more demonstrative. But it's still very intertwined with the orchestral parts. And then with the Britten diversions, that's the closest that we have to a virtuoso part, but the lines are still very intertwined with the orchestra. It's almost like a chamber music piece in a way, with a more flamboyant side to it. So all three concertos are very democratic in the way they approach the concerto model and the relationship between the soloist and the orchestra.
Oh, that's very nice to hear. And of course, with the Britten, it's for the left hand only, dedicated to Paul Wittgenstein. And you say that Britten never attempted to imitate a two piano technique, more revel in the one-handedness. How does this come across in his writing?
Well, when you look at left-handed pieces, whether they're for solo piano or concerto, composers tend to go one of two ways. They either try to cover up the fact that it's left-handed by writing very thick textures that sound as if you might need two, or, you know, in the case of Ravel's concerto, three hands to play them.
Okay.
Or they really go down and lean into the one-handedness of the genre. And that's what Britten does in the diversions. It's very clear throughout that the pianist is only playing with one hand, but he celebrates this and celebrates what the pianist can do with those resources to hand.
But surely it's technically still quite challenging, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's not easy by any means. It took less time to learn the notes because there were fewer of them. But then there was a massive challenge with the stamina required for the piece. For left-hand works in general, again, whether the solo or concerto, stamina for me is the biggest issue. And in trying these works, I realise just how much of a break you get when you're playing two-hand repertoire, because although it's very thick and cognitively you've got an enormous amount going on, your arms can take a break while the other one sort of covers for them. So, but in the left-hand concertos and the left-hand repertoire, you're reliant on this one arm and it's utterly exhausting.
Do you know, that's very interesting. Were you aware of not overusing it, you know, to cause strain to your left hand?
I had to be very careful, both in preparation and in the recording sessions. In preparation to make sure I didn't injure myself, and in the recording sessions to make sure that I had enough stamina to take me through the whole, you know, 6 hours and the extra time we spent recording the cadenzas. Because recording sessions are always more tiring than normal playing, as it were, because it's so intense and you have to really be playing at peak level constantly. But with the one arm, again, the challenges are just multiplied, you know, tenfold.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, yes. Oh, my goodness. And obviously, there's a certain way you sit at the piano. I sometimes see people hold on with their right hand onto the side of the piano. Some do, some don't. Mm. Do you have a preference, or does it just depend what you're playing at the time?
I vary. So I always shift the piano stool to the right a little so that the left hand can reach the higher octaves more easily, and I do often bolster myself by holding onto the right hand side of the piano. I mean, it's given me renewed and increased respect for people who specialize in left hand repertoire alone, because the challenges really are immense.
Very, very, very interesting. Now, this concerto actually wasn't an easy ride for Britten, was it, with Wittgenstein? I believe Wittgenstein altered the score for his own virtuoso purposes.
Yes, so Wittgenstein had lost his right arm during the First World War, and he and his family were very wealthy, so he was able to commission a vast number of concertos, 19 in total, from the leading composers of the day. But he had very specific aims in mind when he commissioned these, so they were, from his perspective, very much showcases for him to further his career. And he was much more aligned with this romantic model of the bravura virtuoso soloist. And when the concertos didn't match that, he had no hesitations in, altering them to suit his specifications. So he often cut a lot of the orchestral parts so that he would be more audible. He, I suppose, stole a variation from the orchestra in Britten Diversions. The beginning of the adagio starts with the strings and the wind coming out,
Oh my
and
goodness.
Wittgenstein rescored that for solo piano. And he also added a number of cadenzas, or short cadenza-like passages between variations in the Britten. But in Ravel's concerto, for example, there are little additions as well, and he amplified the cadenzas, adding extra voices, extra glissandi. He pulled out all the stops. In Ravel's, it's uncomfortable enough for us with a sort of modern aesthetic where you do what the composer tells you. But in Britten's concerto, when you have these bizarre, stylistically inappropriate cadenzas between the variations that don't match Britten's style. I mean, it's fascinating, but it's also very uncomfortable to witness what he did to the work.
That's amazing. I mean, I believe your doctorate was actually on the Library of Wittgenstein's commissions.
Well, I looked at the Britten and the Ravel concertos in detail and at the alterations that Wittgenstein made to them.
Oh, how very interesting. But Britten wasn't happy, was he? I mean.
No. No, he wrote to a friend after the premiere in Philadelphia and said that he'd dashed to Philadelphia to hear Wittgenstein wreck my diversions. So I think, he was unhappy. And Wittgenstein had exclusive, had a contract that said no other pianists were allowed to play it for a certain amount of time after he commissioned it. And he altered, so he performed it extensively with the alterations. But in the 50s, Britten then took the score, revised it, made his own approved version, and of course that's the one that we used for the recording.
Oh, okay, yes, because I believe was it the first recording was the one that he liked was made in 1954 with Julius Katchen at the piano.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
How very interesting. I also love the story behind Tippett's piano concerto, in that you say that it was Walter Gieseking's interpretation of the Beethoven fourth piano concerto that inspired Tippett to write his concerto.
Well, I think again, this idea of reacting against romantic models. I think many composers at this time weren't quite sure how to move forward with a piano concerto because this bravura virtuoso idea had been done to death during the romantic period, but they needed another way to approach it. And Tippett had heard a rehearsal of Walter Gieseking rehearsing Beethoven's fourth concerto and was really impressed by what he called the lyrical and poetic capabilities of the piano, and he wanted to explore those in his work, and he really does that. And although the styles are very, very different, I mean, Tippett doesn't sound like Beethoven, it doesn't feel like Beethoven to play. Texturally, it's very different under the hands. There's still some similarities. There's this beautiful, delicate, limpid tone that they both get at the opening of the concertos, and these lines that, they're very. They're beautifully wrought and constructed, but they still feel very delicate in some way. And I think there's certainly a similarity of spirit between the two works.
Fascinating, fascinating. I mean, what was it like learning and then recording these works?
Oh, it was intense. I mean, orchestral concerto recordings are always quite intense because you have a very limited time and you can't exceed the sessions. So we had to get all three concertos down in 6 3-hour sessions. And we actually split those. We had 2 days of recording, I think in March, and then a day in July. So fortunately, I didn't have to have all three concertos ready to go in 1 week. But it was still really, really intense, but very fulfilling.
Oh, which one did you save for July?
I'm trying to remember now. I think we did the Britten and the Walton together, and then we did the Tippett in July because that's just so mammoth. We wanted to really be able to concentrate on
Okay, no, it's fascinating. Now I'd like to kind of go back a bit in time. And I'd like to know about your background because you grew up in Nottingham, which is my hometown. What was it like as a pianist, as a young pianist for you in Nottingham?
I loved Nottingham growing up there. As a pianist, I suppose in retrospect, I was very isolated. I had a wonderful teacher, and I used to play oboe in the Nottingham Youth Orchestra. So I knew everyone who was doing sort of orchestral instruments in the area, but there weren't very many pianists. So I didn't really have a sense of, what people were doing, what the options were. And then when I was in my late teens, I went to the Chet Summer School. And that was really a baptism of fire, and I suddenly realized, I had to up my game and what there is
Fantastic.
for.
The wonderful Chetham Summer School.
Yeah,
Goodness.
it was a great experience, but I realized I had to buckle down then.
Wow, how fascinating. Did you go there once or a couple of summers or
I
just?
think I went 2 or 3 times. Yeah.
Lovely, lovely. A lot of readers go there, they love it. And then, but then you decided to go on to Cambridge rather than go to the more normal music conservatory. You went for Cambridge University.
Well, I'd really enjoyed the academic work I'd done at school, and I wanted to do that a little more intensively before I turned to music full time. And Cambridge was a great experience. I met some wonderful friends there, and it was a very exciting time of my life. So I'm glad that I did that.
That's fantastic. And while you were there, I mean, obviously, I know. Your repertoire is vast. I mean, did you discover lots of repertoire while you were there or later on, such as Chaminade, Mon Géru, all those wonderful French female composers?
Well, I'd always been interested in unusual repertoire, and that started before university, really. Obviously, Cambridge gave me an opportunity to explore many different areas of the repertoire, academically or in chamber music with friends or through concerto opportunities there. And I really started exploring contemporary repertoire in my mid-20s, I suppose. I had done some before, but I was accepted onto the Park Lane Group scheme in 2010. And that sort of started my interest in contemporary music. I made a recording. I started working with a lot of living composers. That became a very important branch of my work. And then in more recent years, I've started looking at not just unfamiliar composers, but with a specific focus on women composers and composers of colour, just because there are so many reasons that are not musical that this repertoire has been neglected. So actually, when you look at it, the pickings are really rich, and obviously there are some pieces that you wouldn't wish to play, but there is a vast array of really exciting music that just hasn't received the airtime that it deserves. And it's a really exciting time to be a performer, to really explore all this unheard repertoire.
No, I know. I mean, I've suddenly fallen in love with, Mel Bonnie and her works, Phoebe and Melisande.
Yes.
I see you're playing them around the UK this autumn. Aren't they just beautiful pieces?
They're stunning, and in many ways they're very simple, but to create something that is so moving, that while it's still so simple and has such depth, that takes real mastery of, of her craft, and I'd love to explore more of her work.
Really, what style would you call Mel Bonnie?
Well, French late romantic, I suppose. There are certain harmonic similarities with Debussy, with Mahler, but it's very much her own voice as well.
No, it's beautiful. Readers, we have had some of her music in the magazine. I think we've had both Phoebe and Melisande inside because they're just such transcendental works. I mean, they really are. But then I looked at your diary, and I think last month you were playing Rack 2 with the Philharmonia at the Royal Albert Hall. So that's something completely different as well, isn't it?
Yes, and I feel very fortunate at the moment that I'm able to combine sort of more unusual areas of the repertoire with the mainstream works. So, that week I was doing Rack 2, and I also did Mozart's Concerto Number 21 with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, and those are two, great core works of the piano repertoire. So I feel that I have a really exciting breadth at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, your diary is so busy with all that varied repertoire. How do you manage your time?
Well, at the moment, I don't feel that I am very well. This week is sort of spinning out of control. But I do, yeah, I'm generally very disciplined with how I split my time. You know, I make sure I plan each day and I have a certain number of hours for practice and I have to get what I need to get done in that time, certain amount for admin, certain amount for parenting, for domestic stuff. So yeah, it's very there are a lot of spreadsheets at the moment.
Yeah, I know what that's like. Yes, but and also, you're very determined to get bring music to new audiences as well. I believe you've done some work in prisons, some performances for prisons.
I do a fair amount of work in prisons and in local primary schools. Earlier in the year, I set up a charity called the Gloucestershire Piano Trust, and that supports the work that I do, bringing live music into prisons and schools. We do about 10 to 12 prison concerts, 36 school concerts a year, and then we've recently had a co-creation project with a composer, Michael Betteridge, where Michael and I have gone into two prisons in Staffordshire for a number of workshops and co-created pieces for solo piano with prisoners, and I'll be playing those in the forthcoming concert season.
Oh my goodness. And what's it like for somebody who's never had contact with classical music for these inmates to hear? Let's say, I know you said you played some Schubert in one of your performances. Is it like an amazing moment for them to discover classical music?
It's really wonderful for me to see the enthusiasm and eyes light up when people encounter live music. Sometimes it's live music for the first time, you know, not just live classical music. They've never heard anyone perform in real time in the same space as them. So for them, and to understand as well how directly music communicates, even if you don't have any prior experience or knowledge of the genre. I had one concert where I was playing one of the Brahms intermezzi, and you know, it was one of the, I can't remember exactly which one, but it veered from deep desperation to, you know, this glowing hope in the way that Brahms does so wonderfully. And one of the guys who'd never heard this kind of music before just completely understood what Brahms was trying to do, and he said, you know, it sounds like he's willing to give it all up and, you know, kill himself one moment, and then, you know, then the hope, and he feels it's worth living again. And just to hear him express that in his own words, and he'd really got to the absolute core and hub, you know, the core of the piece. That was astonishing for me. And to see, you know, people of all ages and backgrounds engage with this music and for it to mean so much to them, that's been enormously, well, fulfilling and satisfying and rewarding for me.
Oh gosh, I'm absolutely sure you're right. You need to continue doing that, and I'm sure you will, won't you?
I mean, you know, from a very selfish perspective, it's really important for me because it reminds me what is at the core of music making, and it's all about communication, and creating links between people, and that aspect of it really comes to the fore in a prison environment.
How fascinating. Oh, it's wonderful. No, I think that's great. Okay, I think now I'm going to ask you some more light-hearted questions that if you could answer just off the cuff, I think these go down very well on our podcast. So Claire, if you could play only one composer from now on, who would it be?
Oh gosh. Well, deciding on the spur of the moment, I think Szymanowski probably. I mean, it would be problematic for my career, but given that
Szymanowski.
it's pretty niche, but I his music is phenomenal because it's so pianistic, but it doesn't fall into formulae. Like virtuosic formally, he always finds a different way to express ideas at the piano, and the range of color and expression. I'm thinking of the Met Op that I did a few years ago. It was, you know, I was constantly finding something new in that music, and the palette of colors is off the scale. So yeah,
My
Szymanowski.
goodness, is there enough repertoire? Is there a lot of Szymanowski repertoire?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was a it was not a practical decision, but there is an enormous amount for piano. Whether you could do an all Szymanowski recital, I don't know,
Oh,
but yeah.
fascinating. Okay, thank you. That's the first. one pianist, dead or alive, you would travel long and far to hear.
Oh, Vladimir Sofronitsky, I think. So he was Scriabin's son-in-law. and recorded a lot of Scriabin's repertoire, and his playing is completely unique. I don't think you could play like that now. I don't think people would tolerate it because it's extreme. But
Okay.
again, the range of colour that he finds and the way that he approaches Scriabin's music in particular is so fearless, and you need that for that kind of repertoire. And I learn a great deal from listening to him play.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, he most probably wouldn't win a piano competition today, would he?
No, he'd be disqualified, I
Oh dear. Okay, one person dead or alive you'd love to play for.
I think Hélène de Monjeru. She's a French composer, contemporary of Mozart, and I recorded a disc of her etudes a few years ago. And her music was astonishing because it was of such high quality, but it was also decades ahead of its time. And she's very much a forgotten voice, but one who's of tremendous importance in the transition from the classical to the romantic period. So someone that should certainly be better known. But apart from being a wonderful composer, she was also a phenomenal improviser and a brilliant teacher. And at the beginning of each of the etudes, there's a long blurb that she's written. And if you read that, you realise what a brilliant pianist she must have been, and just such an insightful thinker about music. And I would love to, spend an afternoon playing to her and listening to her and experimenting. I think that would be quite an astonishing
Interesting.
experience.
Was her music, was she famous during her lifetime?
No, she was a very private person, and she wasn't a brilliant businesswoman. And there were obviously many barriers to her music being heard because of her sex. So it, yeah, but I think of all the music that I have come across over the past few years, hers is the most astonishing discovery because it is just so significant, musically,
Yes.
but also stylistically and historically.
Yes. Yeah, your CD of her etudes is, well, CD recording of her etudes is just fantastic.
Thank
Yeah.
you.
Do you have any technical struggles at the piano?
Yes, they're often to do now with how, well, to do with how the piano is structured. So the biggest issue I have is repeated notes. And that's mainly because on the piano in general, the note has to rebound before you can restrike it, obviously. And many pianos don't rebound quickly. And it varies massively between makes and within makes. So you never quite know how a piano is going to respond. And that can be really difficult when you have something like I'm doing Mira by Ravel at the moment. And in Alborada del Gracioso, there's that phenomenally rapid repeated note passage. And I turn up at concert venue and I've got no idea if that's going to work or not, because it varies so massively depending on how the piano has been set up. So that's the biggest problem at the moment.
Oh my goodness. So what happens if you turn up at a venue and they haven't got the keys that could do those quick rebounds?
You have to fudge it. And I have various techniques that make it sound like it's repeating, or you can put a little pedal down to give some atmosphere and bring up the volume of the other voices and just hope people believe that the repeated notes are still there. I shouldn't be saying this. I'm revealing all my trade secrets.
Fantastic. I just love it. I love it. I love it. Wow. Okay. In your interview for the magazine, you say that you really find that learning a piece away from the piano is invaluable.
It's really important to be able to separate your idea of a piece from your physical memory and how it feels in the hands. Because when you're nervous or under pressure in a concert situation, physical memory, in my experience, is the first thing to go. So to have a really solid conception of the piece where you're thinking about patterns, you're analysing it, you're hearing it in your mind without having the sound from the instrument, that's really important to make it resilient.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, there's something about the nerves, isn't there, that your physical just dissolves when you're up there sometimes. Yes. What would be your advice to an amateur pianist about how to improve?
Do a little bit each day and have a very clear idea of what you're trying to achieve in that time, and set your own goals. Like, don't try to attain, don't reach for something that's far too complicated initially. Like, if you do a tiny bit of make incremental progress each day, you will be able to make, a great deal of progress over time. But lots of do a little often, I think,
Yes,
is the best advice.
I think you're right. If you weren't a pianist, what would you be?
I think that I used to think I would. I mean, I love languages. I love learning languages, and to do something related to that would be brilliant. But the pandemic taught me that when I'm not performing, I am a very miserable human being. So
Oh,
I don't know what I would be like if
if you couldn't
I
perform
guess
again.
you'd adapt, wouldn't you? I'd have to adapt. But yeah, something to do with languages.
Oh, okay. Finally, one composer you're not quite ready to tackle.
I think I've been fairly brave in tackling most composers, sometimes perhaps unwisely, given that everyone has a style that suits them best or, repertoire that suits them. At the moment, I feel I really need to engage more with Bach. I've done some of his toccatas and preludes and fugues in the past, but I haven't done it for a while, and I would need to completely recalibrate how I approach his music. That would be a big project, and that's something I'd like to do in the next few years.
Oh,
But
yes.
yeah.
That's a very big project indeed. Oh, my goodness. Well, and I think this autumn or at the end of the year, you'll be recording another album for BIS Records. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I'm doing an album of French music. We've got Ravel's Mérat and the Sonatine, and then there are pieces by Cécile Geminade, Germaine Taillefer, Mel Bonnier, and Elsa Behrens.
Ah, oh, okay. I've heard of them all, but I haven't heard of Elsa Behrens. Maybe you could enlighten us.
She was active from the 40s onwards, and apart from being a phenomenal composer, was also part of the French resistance during the war. So she must have been a phenomenally courageous person, an organist as well. Her music is not well known, and I had real difficulty tracking down the piano part for this. Her publisher had been bought up several times by different groups, and there wasn't a formal catalogue anywhere. So it took a long time to find out who published the piece and how I could get a copy. But her voice is very distinctive. If anything, it sounds most like Poulenc, but again, it's her own style. And I'm doing a march that she called a March for Spring Without Love. There are some really powerful works from the wartime, from her wartime oeuvre as well. So she wrote a cantata called Avis or Avis. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Avis. Which is sung from the perspective of a member of the resistance the night before they're executed.
Oh, my
And
goodness.
apart from the subject matter, the music itself is incredibly powerful. And she is certainly a voice who deserves to be heard more widely. She worked extensively with French radio for many decades.
Okay. Has it been recorded before, Bahrain's
The
repertoire?
march that I'm doing hasn't, so this will be
Okay.
a world premiere recording.
How wonderful. You'll have to go and play it in France, I guess.
I'd love to.
Oh, Claire. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I hope the recording goes really well.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been lovely.
I think at the end of this week you've got recitals this week, don't you?
I'm playing at the National Gallery on Friday.
Yeah.
Doing an evening recital and then a children's concert the next day.
Wonderful. Well, I think I'll be there.
Oh,
Yeah,
lovely. It'll
it'll
be
be
good to see.
great seeing you. But I'm sure listeners will have found this really, really interesting. And good luck with the rest of the year.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, Claire. That was the opening of Hélène de Montgeroux's Étude in A major, and it was performed by Claire Hammond. Pianist podcasts are free, and a really good way to support what we do is by subscribing to Pianist. Visit our website at pianistmagazine.com and listen to us on YouTube by searching Pianist Magazine. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter, which is full of extra playing tips and useful information. Go to pianistmagazine.com to find out how to sign up.